I've been looking forward to this podcast for a long time since we booked this guest. And I am joined from Louisville, Kentucky, by one of my good friends, a longtime friend, and one of the greatest managers of all time, Jim Cornette. Corny, thank you for being with us here.
Well, thank you, JR. And like George Burns said when he was 99, right before he died, I can't die, I'm booked.
Right. Well,
and I appreciate the booking. It's nice to be had. I have been had many times.
I know that. We'll get into that later. I want to thank you. In the beginning, I haven't talked to you since WrestleMania. I want to thank you for coming by the House of Blues and joining me on our show. It was a nice surprise for the fans because, you know, I didn't know you were gonna be able to come for sure until I saw you. And I'm really happy that you came by and you added a lot to the show, and I just appreciate it.
To be honest, I worked Mid-South Wrestling, lived in Louisiana for a year, never went to Bourbon Street.
Wow.
Because in those days, obviously, I would have been killed.
Yes, you would.
I would have been hung from one of the statues on Bourbon Street. So I couldn't expose myself to the public. But I can cross that off my bucket list now that I've worked the stage at the House of Blues in New Orleans in the French Quarter.
Right.
And one guy on Twitter said, nice of Cornette to dress up. I'd been out there for 8 hours. We had lunch out there. We met up with some friends who shall remain nameless in case I have political enemies. But we went back and had some more drinks and oysters. And then I got there early to see you and Court Bauer, and who I'm affiliated with on my podcast, The Jim Cornette Experience on MLW.com.
Right.
But I'd been out there about 8 hours, so I had a T-shirt and warm-up pants on because it was, as you know, very humid, as Louisiana always is. It's 110% humidity 24 hours a day, so I was dressed casually. And you asked me to come up, and I can cross that off my bucket list now because I've worked the House of Blues stage in New Orleans with Jim Ross.
There you go. Well, we worked at the same you got the same amount of experience on stage as I have one night. That's good though. But I had fun seeing you, and I'm glad you were there. And I didn't give a damn what you were wearing. That was fine with me.
But Mr. Blackwell on Twitter was hot about it. But you know, I thought I was good because that's my gimmick now. I'm not in the wrestling business anymore. I'm in the Jim Cornette business. So.
Right.
Yep. I had the Popeye playing poker T-shirt and the sweatpants on. Usually I wear Cornette face, but not out in public because I'm not that wrapped up in myself.
You know, one that brings up, this is a nice little organic segue, about your attire. Because when I went on Twitter and I said, hey, I've got Jim Cornette coming on our show and he's going to be on our podcast, got any questions? And one of the questions I got, believe it or not, several times was how did you come up with the attire that you wore when you were managing all the bright colors and the what gave you that motivated you to dress that way? Was there a role model or just your own idea?
Well, you know, actually, when I first started managing, Jerry Jarrett, when he asked me to be a manager, he said, come back next week with a suit. And I own no suits. You know, I'm 19 years old, so I Mike Duncan, who was Christine Jarrett's nephew and was an announcer and TV announcer in Tennessee and Kentucky and used to come to the Louisville matches, his full-time job was at a men's store in Nashville at the mall.
Uh-oh.
And I said, Mike, can I get some suits, right? And he said, yeah, come down, I'll take care of you. So the statute of limitations has run out, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was 1982.
He
would ring up every third item because I'm making $400 a week. I just got in the wrestling business, and so he would ring up every third item, and I got suits, and they were really nerdy suits, like gray and brown and black, and you know the rich kid, right? But then, being from Louisville, now that I'm looking for suits, Derby time comes around, and they've got the red blazers and the green blazers and the pinks and I said, boy, that would get some heat. And then I started looking for the most colorful off-brand stuff that I could find. And by the time I got to Louisiana, I was doing the yachting hat and the red blazer with the, you know, psychedelic tie, and it just kind of built on itself and people reacted to it. So I kept doing it.
I just now thought of that yachting, that captain's hat. That gets heat with me now. It's been 30 years ago, so I'm just kidding. I don't know.
When I moved from Louisville to Nashville in March of 1983, I had some friends driving a truck, and Kenny, Star Maker Boland, was with me. It's Kenny.
God, Kenny.
And we were all, I had like six hats that I bought at Caulfield's Novelty, yachting hats.
Right, yeah.
And we all were wearing the yachting hats,
Thurston
driving
Howell,
my car
Thurston
and the
Howell
U-Haul down to Nashville to begin my wrestling adventure.
You're the Thurston Howell the Third of Gilligan's Island fame with the yachting hat.
Beloved.
Hell yes, exactly. Well, so how did a tennis racket come into play?
To be honest, at the same time, Cowboy, Bill Watts, had flown us down Thanksgiving week to do our first TVs in Shreveport from Nashville,
mm-hmm.
me and Bobby Eaton, Dennis Condrey. And I didn't have a tennis racket. And maybe the second TV, I don't know, I didn't have it either. But before we started full-time Christmas week, I went to the movies with my girlfriend at the time in Nashville and saw one of those teen flicks that was popular at the time, and the rich kid in the group was always carrying a badminton racket around. And, you know, that registered, and at the same time, all the boys had told me, the fans in Louisiana will kill you, Cornette. They're going to rape you, sodomize you with a rusty fishing knife, and leave you laying in a gutter somewhere. It's not the Memphis fans were kind of tame at that point. They were riotous in the 70s, but... So I needed reach, and you saw a bunch of them, JR. Don't
yep.
tell me you haven't.
Oh, yeah.
You saw a bunch of them where the fans were trying to kill me.
Absolutely.
So I needed reach on the fans and something to carry. Managers had umbrellas, canes, briefcases,
mm-hmm.
but never a tennis racket.
Right.
Because the tennis racket, of course, was bigger and heavier than the badminton racket.
Right.
And then in Tulsa and some of the other places where we knew we were going to have a riot, every show I would load it with a horseshoe and a dog chain and some things duct taped to it underneath that gave me a little... The horseshoe that I still have to this day that I carry for luck, I've had it on every airplane I've ever been on.
Wow.
I carry it with me in my toiletry bag every place I drive. Was thrown at me in Tulsa at the Assembly Center.
Wow.
I look up, I'm in the ring, we're being introduced, and here comes the horseshoe, a legitimate metal horseshoe, coming toward me, and I ducked, and it landed in the ring, and I picked it up, and I kept it for luck, because it didn't kill me, and I used to put that in the racket, so now the secret can be revealed.
Oklahoma horseshoe, been with you everywhere.
Exactly. I turned a negative into a positive.
That's good,
Vince,
though.
Vince used to say.
No, that's a smart... That's a smart deal, and you did need the gimmick in Louisiana because that was in an era where heels actually had heat. They were legitimately despised. I said on a podcast not long ago that the absence of no rules, seemingly no rules in wrestling, is a detriment because it makes it virtually impossible for a heel to get any real steam or any heat because closed fists are legal, pulling the boots legal. I mean, there's you need rules in wrestling so that the heels can break them.
Well, how can you cheat if nothing is against the law? And you know, the thing is that, and I know your friend Happy Heyman,
yeah,
and he'll hate me for saying this, but ECW was revolutionary, but at the same time, it numbed people and began the trend of the attitude, etc. It numbed people to things that were legitimately harmful to the human being.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting guys on fire. Guys are being thrown through tables and barbed wire and thumbtacks, etc., etc. It numbs people to what is legitimately harmful, and as a result, you can't make that shock impact on people anymore. Oh, my God, he's broken his leg with the figure four leg lock.
Yeah.
No, we just saw this guy get lit on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gone too far in a lot of ways. I just think that, you know, I was talking when I was in New Orleans, talking to some of the producers/agents, ex-wrestlers who are coaching, for those who don't know, back in the locker room area, helping their talents out. They're saying, man, It is so challenging for a wrestler to be a heel in today's marketplace because there are really no rules for them to break to get people to dislike them. And they don't. And the heels, more often than not, Corny, they don't know how to sell like a heel. They don't know. In general, in our business, people don't sell enough. And people then forget there's a nuance in learning how to sell as a heel and learning to sell as a babyface. You know, in my view.
You know, in one aspect, first of all, heels should have no redeeming social value. They should be cowards when the tide is turned.
Sure.
They should be cocky when they're on top due to illegal means.
Mm-hmm.
They should be obnoxious, arrogant, and condescending in their tone. And when I did the Midnight Express book a few years ago, I was able to go back and tabulate that there were probably 100 people in my career as a manager that literally went to jail to take a swing at me in front of a cop. Many times connected, but sometimes a swing was enough. But I antagonized people to that point because there was nothing redeeming about me. Even when I did the one-liners and the funny patter on TBS, and you were a part of much of that. For the people who were with it, it was entertaining, it was funny, that was fine. But for the vast majority, I was insulting their wife or their husband or their girlfriend or their family member or their hero,
right,
the Rock and Roll Express, and I was a smartass. And so it worked doubly. Of course, now the secrets are out, the toothpaste is out of the tube, and it's harder for a heel to get heat because most people know that he's being manipulated somehow to say these things on purpose to get a rise, to yank our crank, so to speak.
Yeah.
But also, it's just in your body language and in your demeanor, as Howard Finkel would say,
yes,
the way you carry yourself as to whether you want people to like you or dislike you. And a lot of guys these days just want to do their stuff and get their pretty stuff in and are not worried enough about making people actively dislike them to,
right,
the point of going to jail to take a swing at them.
Right. Yeah. I and especially not only in the heels in the ring, but the art of being a great manager is almost extinct. It's like the white rhino. There may be more white rhinos in roaming the wilds of Africa than there are really good wrestling managers. I think I could probably say that conclusively. And I'm not even Jack Hanna or...
Well, now, what do you got to get racist for? Why white rhinos?
Well, they're just
Why
rare.
Can't we just outnumber rhinos.
It's rare. I don't know. I just thought of that. I could be... it's just that, Heyman, you mentioned Paul earlier. Paul is doing some of his best work right now as a manager because he knows how to cut a promo. And I said on a tweet the other day that Paul Heyman has the gift of being able to easily piss people off in fiction and in nonfiction.
Oh, I told Paul when he came to we had gone to Dusty because we were at kind of wit's end when Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson gave notice and left to go to the WWF,
right,
in 1988. And we were in a big money world tag title match program with them. And we ended up with the belts and then dropped them to the Road Warriors, who were going elsewhere. And we went to Dusty and said, we need somebody to work with. Can we bring in the original Midnight, Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, and Paulie Dangerously?
Mm-hmm. They don't even work here.
They were with Vern.
No,
but
so
TV from ESPN. But I figured it was a natural program.
Yeah.
And I even told Paul on the phone, I said, only Genghis Khan and you could turn me babyface, right? Because at that point it was going to be, he may be a prick, but he's our prick.
Yeah.
With the fans. And Dusty, pulled the trigger on it, brought him in. We did the thing. He whacked me with the phone. I bled out almost on TBS. And
right,
you uttered the immortal line, which got it over. They don't even work here, exactly. But Paul is, I've always respected him for his ability to not only do a great promo and as a great television personality, but also his mind with manipulating wrestling as far as getting the most out of the least and getting the most out of his talent. I wouldn't believe him what he says if his tongue was notarized, but we have that relationship.
Yeah, he's doing a great job right now. His promos are excellent. And, you know, staying on the subject of managers, one of the neat things about going to New Orleans, because I made a late decision to stay during the weekend. WWE invited me, and I kind of went back and forth. You know, do I need to go or do I belong or whatever? So I decided, you know, okay, I'll go. And because I wanted to kind of go to the Hall of Fame, was sort of the biggest thing of the weekend for me. And I met Paul Bearer's two sons. And that was a real cool deal.
Michael and,
Daniel maybe?
Michael and I can't remember the other man's name, but
he actually
tweeted us also. And a real nice tweet, and I thank him because Stace was reading it in the car about, you know, what I meant to Percy, what Percy meant to me, and all the things, great yep. things I'd said about him, et cetera. He was very proud of the weekend at
yeah.
the point.
Well, it was a good it was good meeting them. It was good seeing Percy honored. You know, I told somebody at the Hall of Fame, I said, you know, you can tell how long you've been in the business by the names you call people. And I never called him Paul. I always called him Percy. And the newer guys that met him when he came to WWF in 92 or 91, where it was, 90, whatever, they called him, he became Paul Bearer to those guys because they didn't know him as Percy. So he was always Percy to me, but it was cool to see.
You know, he was always Percy to all the guys in the wrestling business, the territory days, et cetera. He was a great wrestling fan, and I had people writing me on the website, jimcornette.com, for those inclined, and you know, asking me by email, well, do you think he would have been insulted that they're using him, you know, in this angle after he passed away at WrestleMania, blah, 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 last year? And I no, he was the biggest wrestling fan in
Absolutely.
The world.
Absolutely.
And he would have been thrilled to be a major part of a main event match at WrestleMania after he was dead. That would have been, he would have been over the moon.
How cool was that? I mean, God bless him. I saw him at the Cauliflower Alley Club, which I go to every year. This year it's in June and in Vegas. Always look for an excuse to go to Vegas, kids, because if you're in the wrestling business, you go to the Cauliflower Alley Club. It's a trip to Vegas that you can legitimately write off your taxes.
There you go.
And it's a great cause. But I thought that when I got some of those same deals, so, you know, emails and on my website, all the same old stuff. How could WWE do that? It's unheard of. And I'm thinking, oh, Paul is up there in heaven, and he is just smiling from ear to ear because you're right. He's dead and gone. God bless him, and rest in peace. But he's got to be tickled to death that he was a major part of an angle after his death at WrestleMania. And I just,
I'll say this: one of my favorite memories of Percy was when I had Smoky Mountain Wrestling operating, and you may have been a part of setting this up, but we had the talent agreement, and mm-hmm. I got The Undertaker and Paul Bearer to come to Pikeville, Kentucky for the Bluegrass Brawl. And people say, Pikeville, Kentucky. We had 2,000 people there in the college gym, sold out, hanging from the rafters. And Undertaker was I was at the time, for some reason, we won't go into that, a babyface, managing the team captain by Bullet Bob Armstrong against the gangsters. The Undertaker was on the side of Right and Might, and I got to manage alongside, not against like I did with Yokozuna mm-hmm. and Taker. Got to manage alongside Paul Bearer. We were on the same side of the ring. It was 125 degrees in that gym, and his makeup, his face was literally melting.
Oh, God.
And he was looking around, and it was like he was back in Mobile in the old days, in the 70s. It was a wrestling show in a small town in a gym. The people are hanging from the rafters. They're screaming. He was having a ball. He was a wrestling fan. And he loved where he was and what he was doing. And I've got a picture hanging on my wall of us looking at each other and about to die. He's melting literally, and I'm melting figuratively.
What were your memories? You know, I got a chance to do some shows for you at Smoky Mountain. Had a good time. I usually rode to your TVs with Dennis Brent would come along with me as my sidekick, you know, and we would make those drives to wherever. And, I you know, it was old school stuff for me. I was kind of when you're telling that story about Paul, I felt the same way being able to come up and do commentary on those Smoky Mountain shows. But when you look back at it, you know, all the kidding aside, the investors or the money or the whatever, what do you look back at Smoky Mountain in a positive, reflective way that makes you feel good?
Oh, my God. You know, almost everything. We were way more successful than anybody gave us a chance to be. You know, at the time where every other territory besides Memphis in the country had gone out of business, we had a few shows. We put some up on the boards, you know, like the NCAA March Madness. We put a few up on the boards, sold out the Knoxville Coliseum a couple of times and came close a couple of more times, drew some, you know, great spot show crowds. When you came up, it was a chance, you know, and all respect to Bob Caudill, who was our broadcaster for so long, and Dutch Mantell did our color, and later on Les Thatcher worked on the program, did the play-by-play. But you were on one of your hiatuses from the WWF and it came up and did the program for like 6 months, and it brought it to a whole nother level as television program. And we did local ratings consistently in the twos and threes and up to an eight in Knoxville, which now, you know, any local program would kill for in these days. But I think the best thing was starting so many guys. You know, we had a mix of veterans and young guys. I never said I just wanted to be the over-the-hill gang. I wanted guys that were over, that the people knew their names, that they would come see them if their name was on a marquee, even if they hadn't seen the TV, but also to lead and teach my young guys. And we started Chris Candido, we started Sonny, and we started Glenn Jacobs, Kane, and we started Lance Storm and Chris Jericho, the first wrestling jobs they had in the United States, and Al Snow, his first TV gig, and, you know, the list goes on, and we were able to not only use the Rock and Roll Express and the Dirty White Boy, Tracy Smothers, Bullet Bob Armstrong as our legend, but also, you know, start so many young guys' careers, and you know, I appreciate the relationship that we had with Vince at that time, where when they were finished with us, they'd go to the big time.
Yeah.
And they could make very good money and have a great opportunity. But, you know, now it was like Smoky Mountain was a low-budget territory. My top guys were only making $500-$600 a week. And now it's almost 20 years later, adjusting for inflation, guys would gut their mothers for $600 a week sometimes.
Yeah. I had a great time there. You know, I worked that big show you had in Knoxville. You taped for a DVD and
the Night of Legends.
Yeah,
yes.
With Les Thatcher. And I always want to. I probably call him Les Thornton a million times. God bless him. but I enjoyed working with Les, and we did fine. And that's where I told. I remember telling Vince that you know, Al Snow was a hell of a talker. You know, he did a good job for somebody that hadn't had a great deal of experience doing color analyst on an hour show. He did really well, but it was good, like you said.
Well, and you know, also I was able to bring down, thanks to your talent relations administration skills, I was able to bring down a lot of the talent. And Undertaker, the first time that Undertaker faced Kane was in 1995 in the Knoxville Civic Coliseum, when it was Undertaker versus Unabomb.
Right.
And Mark was able to go back and tell Vince, hey, I can draw a fortune with this guy on pay-per-view. I remember when Vince called me and said, I'm making him an evil dentist. And I think it's because Vince went to the dentist that day and was in a cranky mood, but he found his spot, because you can't, you know, you can bury talent, but you can't kill it. It'll always stick that hand up through the buried alive set and resurface.
People don't understand that today. Sometimes they kill so and so. You know, it's like the wrestling business. It's just so resilient. But I can tell you this: if the WWE had or any company, we talk about WWE because they're the biggest game in town a lot. But if any wrestling organization or any company in general had an office full or a locker room full or whatever was applicable of human beings like Glenn Jacobs, they would be much better off, because he is as quality a guy as that I know that I ever signed and brought into WWE. Nobody any better, less maintenance, adapted to every situation, and he's smart and he's articulate. If I would think he'll be at WWE in some capacity forever, until he's just absolutely ready to go back to Knoxville and say, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah, and the only problem I ever had with Glenn Jacobs was when he couldn't get my fat ass up for the choke slam. And that was my problem. But, you know, that's the thing. You know, a guy like Glenn, and you talk about it, of course, you can bury talent repeatedly until maybe people don't want to see it. But that's one of the problems of not having a territory system because, you know, how can I miss you if you won't go away? Sometimes it's time for guys to go home and come back in 2 years with a fresh look, new coat of paint, learn a new hold. And they used to be able to do that by going to work for somewhere else. And now, unfortunately, they tend to cling to that national TV spotlight until it's past their prime, mm-hmm. past their expiration date. And our friend Mick Foley's one of the only guys who's sometimes known when to quit and quit.
Yeah.
And come back later when it was more advantageous and take that gamble because he knew that he had something to offer.
Well, it's a different world, and the territories. I said this a long time ago when we formed those developmental operations in Memphis, in Louisville, and in Cincinnati. I said some of us have got to realize, and everybody in the business should realize that the death of the territories is going to have an adverse effect on the overall business significantly in the years to come. Now, I don't know what year it's going to be. But it's going to be imminent, I mean, like in the next decade type thing. And sure enough, you're seeing now the remnants of the erosion of the territories and the fact that guys have nowhere to go to learn to work in front of a paying audience. And that is the key. You got to learn to work in front of a paying audience.
You know, that's why I was just real briefly a few weeks ago at WrestleMania weekend loved being at the Mid-South Wrestling Fan Fest and sitting there and listening to the Bill Watts Q&A, which I hosted and basically pointed at people and said, your question,
yeah.
And let Bill run with it from there. But in Mid-South Wrestling, you had guys like Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed and Hacksaw Duggan, the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express, guys in their Terry Taylor, guys in their 20s and early 30s making a name for themselves, drawing big money, huge television ratings, big crowds in major arenas all over the area, who needed a, for lack of a better term, a military school environment where you had big leadership from the office, mm-hmm. and somebody's eye on you, and don't screw up and do right. this, and the long trips, you didn't have time to screw up. Well, some people found time, but
yeah.
Conversely, over in Dallas, you had short trips and a lot of time off and a major metropolitan area where a lot of guys got bad habits and caught up in things because mm-hmm. they were celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the cowboy, and that's what's wrong with me today. That was my first taste of the big time, of main eventing the Superdome in front of 25,000 people when I'm 22 years old, and this is the way you do it. And I saw it work, and I can't get out of that to my detriment these days. But I loved seeing Bill explain his reasoning for the things he did, which make perfect sense to me. And the guys sometimes hated him, but 30 years later, they're like, wow, what he did for me.
Yeah, you know, Michael Hayes is still bitching about his payoff, work with the dog in the Superdome, you know, all those years ago. And I've told him about 10 times to get over it. And he says, I think he enjoys it, actually. He enjoys bringing it up and venting, and it makes him feel better.
He's still employed 30 years later because of that match. So,
yeah.
What do they call it? The accountants when they depreciate the payoff.
Right. Yeah. He did all right, and he's still making a living off what he learned in the territory days. And I kid him about it because I bring it up just to piss him off sometimes.
Poke the bear.
Yeah, that's it. I want to get to several things in this second half of our visit. Again, great talking to you as always. You know, I've always said that I believe that we're too Southern for anything else, but everybody's been telling us for years we're too Southern to work together. But I think that if we could go to CMT with a demo tape of those lipstick cameras, you know, on the dashboard of the car,
there you
like
go.
A cash cab or that taxi cab confessions, those kind of deals, that we could drive from coast to coast and just stop and eat fried food here, there, and yon. and have us a hell of a little reality show.
Well, you know, that's the thing. They said we were too Southern when we were together in New York. But as far as I think anything south of the Mason-Dixon, we're just about right.
Yeah, I agree with you. Hey, a lot of things.
And I got to say one thing real quick. Just your show at the House of Blues. Because I sat and you said, hey, you can watch the monitor and I'll bring you out. And I said, no, I want to sit outside like a mark because that's why I came. And watching your show, a lot of people are used to Jim Ross, the broadcasting icon, and your cadence there. But the way you speak to your fans at the Q&A and at the one man show, it's just like having a conversation with you on the phone. So anybody wants to know what it's like to just talk to JR, go to your show wherever you hold it, and you will get that experience.
The next one's in Toronto, so. I don't expect to see you there because it's a hell of a drive, and I know you ain't flying.
Well, no, actually, I've got problems with the Canadian border, but we won't even talk about that
session.
Well, we'll leave that for the return.
I didn't mean to bring that up. But,
you had an issue one time, but I had an even bigger problem a couple of years ago, and yeah. I'll tell you about that later on in private.
Okay. I had to pay $200 one time to enter the country because I had a DUI in Atlanta in the late 80s.
Well, I've been to Canada 25 times in the last 20 years, and the last time I went, about 3 years ago, in driving my own vehicle, registered to me, with no outstanding warrants and warrants, carrying no contraband, a middle-aged tourist in the car with my wife, they ran my record and said, 1984, arrest, assault, Baton Rouge, 1985.
Stop it.
And they wouldn't even let me pay. I said, well, what's it going to take to clear this up? They said, you need to get a letter signed from the prime minister.
That's what I did.
You can come back to this country.
I said,
well, you know what? that'll be when I get an engraved invitation. Yeah. Just let me out of here.
I got that. It's crazy. I wanted to ask you, one of the big news items, of course, occurred at WrestleMania 30, was Brock Lesnar defeating the Undertaker to his 21-match winning streak over. I was shocked. I tweeted it that night. I wrote about it for FoxSports.com, which is why I watched the event from the hotel, and I didn't go to WrestleMania, and I was just a few blocks away. I didn't like it, the streak ending, and I was shocked that it did. Be that as it may, it happened. So what were your thoughts on the streak ending?
Well, I had said on my podcast previously, there's some things it takes 20 years to get to a point like that. There's some things that the people don't want to see. They want that feel-good moment for everything that The Undertaker and the man behind The Undertaker has done for the business, for the WWF, E. I thought it should be the feel-good moment every year at WrestleMania. Who's going to take it down, but nobody ever does, and he triumphs over adversity, and it's the feel-good moment. And I also said that sometimes people think they might want to see something in wrestling, but when they see it, it's more of a downer. It's more of a, oh, and it doesn't get the guy that beat the streak over at that point. It just diminishes the guy that was in charge of the streak. And here's the thing. I didn't see WrestleMania. I was actually driving back and got into Louisville about 10 o'clock that Sunday night, driving back from New Orleans. So even if I'd watched it on TV, sometimes you know this, you can only tell in the arena when you hear the people. Are they mad at the guy that did it, or does the air come out of them and they just go, oh, I feel bad?
Yeah.
You don't want a feel-bad moment. Mad draws money. Sad doesn't draw money. But I don't know what it was. Maybe you don't even know what it was watching on television. But, was this Undertaker? Certainly Undertaker was on board with it because it wouldn't have happened if he wasn't. So,
right.
Therefore, I'm not going to second-guess it right now because I have respect for Mark Calloway. Was this his last match, and he just didn't want to make a big deal out of it, and he wanted to pass the torch and do what was right for business? Is Brock going to be more than just a part-time guy? Is he going to increase his appearances and help business? Is this something that registered with the fans as a shocking event that's going to draw money and make a new star, or is it something that's going to just diminish the people that were involved because it was something they really didn't want to see? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder about these things, but yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's if you're a fan, and I've got it on Twitter, you know, I haven't gotten very many much feedback from anybody that says they liked it. But I have some. I have a lot of people were just very, very disappointed and had a negative reaction. They didn't have a positive negative reaction, if you know what I mean. It's like
yeah.
you said.
Let me set something straight right now, because this was a question that was written into my email. Well, do you think that Undertaker let Brock Lesnar end the streak because he was an MMA guy and he's really tough and people know that, and if he was going to lose somebody, he wants to lose somebody that that he felt really could beat him. It's sort of like his Luthez in the 50s, right?
Yeah, come on.
And knowing the Undertaker, that's probably, you know, number 14 on the list of reasons why he would have done that,
yeah.
And I think you would concur.
Absolutely would concur. Here's the deal. We're not going to know. I was disappointed to see it happen because for this reason. I always thought that it would stay intact until he was ready to saddle up like John Wayne or Clint Eastwood and ride off in the credits roll. Because I always thought that, you know, my idea of a greatest, my latest brainstorm of booking for me was...
We both have those a lot, especially when we're in the bathroom.
Yeah, you know, reading, sitting there. I thought that, well, here's a hell of an angle. Undertaker wins the Royal Rumble and the Rumble before they play Texas Stadium. And he wins the Rumble, and he goes and says, and he wrestles a champion. The champion is John Cena. Well, not too far-fetched. John's been champion a lot. And people always want Cena to turn heel. So Undertaker wins the Rumble. He says, I'm either going to win the title or I'm going to retire. So he goes to WrestleMania 32 in Texas Stadium. You got 100,000 people there. The Undertaker's either going to win the title in his home state of Texas or he's going to lose and retire. And then you get the people doing all the conspiracy stuff saying, well, this is a perfect opportunity for Cena to turn heel. He'll screw the Undertaker. Undertaker will have to retire. Cena couldn't get any hotter as a heel at that time. So that's what they book. What you do is you have Undertaker go over. He wins the title. And the next night on Raw, he comes out and says, you know, and better said than this, it's over. I'm done. I proved my point. I'm going out the way I wanted to go out. I gave you all I had. I left everything I had in the ring. There's nothing left. I have too much respect for the championship to be a part-time champion. And he said, I am retiring as the champion of WWE. And he lays the belt in the ring and leaves. So now you got a tournament you can have and your main event's made for your next pay-per-view. And that's a nice, that was my little storyline. I liked it because...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the words of Kid Rock, if it looks good, you'll see it. If it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it is good, you'll feel it. And that's why that people who have experience in the wrestling industry can feel these things and come up with these things, as Kenny Bolin would say, on the sperm of the moment, that defeat and outrank the things that the writers with degrees from major universities come up with.
You know, one of the...
And I like it, but, you know, it's too late now.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's too late to turn back now. I believe we've
yeah.
fallen into...
Yeah. We haven't fallen in love with that one. That's over.
Yeah.
But it was a nice fantasy booking for a couple of seconds. Hey, how do you... Speaking of booking, I said, and I defended it all along, that... If you grew up in a territory era, or if you were a fan of it, like you and I were kids, and watched it religiously, you're lucky because you lived in Louisville where you could see more than one show. I lived in rural eastern Oklahoma, saw 1 hour a week.
You were lucky to have television.
Yeah, well, that's true. I if I didn't do my chores, the old man was not going to let me watch wrestling because he hated it. My dad would say, now here's the deal, son. If a guy gets on that second rope and he hits another guy exactly 10 times every time, and there's no blood, there's no black eye, there's no puffiness, there's no red marks, there's no teeth missing, there's no bloody nose, there's no busted lip, it's not real. And I said, well, you know, Dad, their skin's tough. You know, he's look at me like I'm an idiot. Like, go out in the barn, and I'll call you when you're ready to come back in the house. I'm going to hit you with a bunch of questions here, real quick answers. What did you like doing better, managing or booking?
Depends on the time frame. With the Midnight Express, I was a manager and didn't want to be anything else. After I had a taste of booking, that was the way to go because then you got to see your creative vision fulfilled.
Would you accept an invitation to be inducted in the WWE Hall of Fame? And if so, what version of the Midnight Express would you want to be with you, or would all three?
I've answered this on a couple of places, but everybody's talking about it. I'm not losing sleep over it. But if I was asked, I did nothing Hall of Fame worthy, in my opinion, in the WWF. But with the Midnight Express, it was in any wrestling Hall of Fame, and all three of them played an equal part. I would not turn it down if the invitation was extended to myself and the Midnight Express, Bobby Eaton, Dennis Condrey, Stan Lane.
Was there ever talk that you're aware of? This question's come from Twitter, and that's why they're quick here. Was there ever talk of a Vader versus Yokozuna match at a WrestleMania?
Not that I'm aware of.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Another question. Favorite fast food chain? When you were, and I know you lost weight, and I have been with you on a couple of car trips, and it seemed like you were partial to Wendy's.
I love Wendy's. I put Wendy through college with my money, but they've changed their recipes. They've changed their meat. They've changed everything from the old days. Fast food service in general is going down. I would recommend, if you're a fast food fan and you're around it in the Midwest, Culver's is excellent. In-N-Out Burger in the West Coast. Don't forget Backyard Burger, and Smash Burger and Five Guys are coming on strong.
What do you think? Are you a Whataburger guy?
Whataburger in Texas.
Yep.
When you get outside of Texas, the people even working there don't know how to handle it. Legitimate Whataburgers only in Texas.
Smash Burger. I haven't tried that.
Smash Burger is hot in the Southeast.
There you go, folks.
It's good.
If you're looking for a franchise or food fix, there you go.
And fried chicken, by the way, the best fried chicken in the world, Hattie B's. Hattie B's fried chicken in Nashville. The best grilled chicken in the world, Nando's in the UK, now spreading to the US. They're in 5 or 6 Washington, D.C. locations.
How did you, quick answer here for this, and I should have started with this maybe or got it in earlier. I had a great time on my tour of the UK. I hope to go back, did good business, and I had fun. It was hard because we did 4 shows and did a lot of driving, but I was raised in Mid-South, so what the hell. How, in a Reader's Digest summary, how was your experience in the UK when you went there?
Oh, my God, I loved it. I loved the people. They're so polite. They're so friendly. I loved the London. We did a lot of sightseeing, amazing buildings, 1,000 years old, amazing architecture. It's expensive to live there, but they have a great minimum wage. It's like the equivalent of $12 an hour. The audiences were great. London's Leicester Square Theater, Cardiff, Manchester, Birmingham, Glasgow, with Inside the Ropes and Kenny McIntosh, along with Alex Shane, WrestleTalk TV. I'm trying to get all the plugs in. I feel like I'm doing an acceptance speech on the Oscars.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I want to go back. I said once in a lifetime. That means in wrestling I can't go back for 2 years, but I will return, as General MacArthur said. A great experience. I crossed another one off my bucket list, and the people were so accepting. My fans on Twitter in the UK. I'm bigger in England than I am in Kentucky, so I don't know why, but a great positive experience.
Yeah, me too. I had a great time there. Very loyal. Our podcast does great there. It's usually number 1 or 2 in the sports categories on iTunes, so I'm very thankful for that. Thankful that you came on the show. And
appreciate it. And I would love to come back, and you've done my show, and now, wait a minute, the possession arrow goes to you. You got to do my show again sometime.
We'll do it.